Hello, it's Debbie, back again on a Wednesday, this one February 15th, 2017, reading the Herald and Review of Decatur on from the e-edition. In the print copy, there is a whole highlighted section, which is the article we'll read first, Illinois' Black Eye. But it looks like a graphic on the front page of the paper. Illinois' Black Eye. Illinois has been without a budget for a full year operating budget for 19 months. While lawmakers have been unable to pass a solution, the state's financial position worsens daily as bills and interest on late payments continue to pile up. As Governor Bruce Rauner prepares to deliver his budget address to the General Assembly today, at noon. Here's a look at the state's financial mess by the numbers. 10.8 billion with a B. State's bill backlog, or a little more than the 2015 gross domestic product of Armenia. 130 million unfunded pension liabilities, or double the production budget of the 2014 film Annie. 595 days. How long Illinois has gone without a budget, more than a giraffe's gestation period, which is 453 to 464 days, in case you wanted to know. $5.3 billion budget deficit as of June 30th, if nothing changes. 1 million. Number of Illinoisans who have lost services from United Way social service agencies, about one in every 13 residents. 1 million Illinoisans have lost service. $83 million interest on the state's late payments for this fiscal year. 1983, Michael J. Madigan became Speaker of the House, a role he's held all but 2 years since then. Top pop single that year, Every Breath You Take by The Police. $187.6 million. Governor Bruce Rauner's adjustable gross income in 2015. He paid about $50 million in income tax. Nine percent of Illinoisans who believe the state is headed in the right direction. Okay, the percent of Illinoisans who believe the state is headed in the right direction are 9.9%. Percent of Americans who say they believe in Bigfoot, 20.6. The sources they've used for this: the Illinois Comptroller's Office, the World Bank, Billboard, Animal Planet, Box Office Mojo, Governor's Office of Management and Budget, Associated Press, General Assembly's Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, Paul Simon Public Policy Institute, Chapman University Survey on American Fears, and the U.S. Census Bureau. Next article. Domestic violence funds go unpaid. This is a local report. Dove Incorporated among domestic violence programs left dry by the state. This is by Allison Petty, Herald and Review digital editor, and John O'Connor, an AP political writer, Decatur. Dove Incorporated was among dozens of providers across Illinois that were not told for months that their domestic violence funding had been cut, Executive Director Christine Gregory confirmed Tuesday. The agency's board of directors voted last week to join a lawsuit against the state in an attempt to collect payment for contracts connected to multiple programs, including domestic violence. The lawsuit, filed in St. Clair County earlier this month, is spearheaded by the Pay Now Illinois Coalition, a group of human and social service agencies and companies. Quote, "It's not as if we were expecting something that we did not have a contract for," Gregory said. "We have contracts with the state that say we were going to be paid this money," unquote. In the case of domestic violence contracts, Dove had already received some money, which it later learned represented the federal portion of its agreements. Late last year, Dove and other agencies learned the state's part of the funding was not included in the six-month budget that took effect July 1st. Quote, "We were given contracts and money was starting to be received," Gregory said. "There was nothing to indicate that anything was amiss until there was," unquote. The state is now $203,000 behind in payment for Dove's domestic violence programs. For the fiscal year, the state has pledged $692,000 through various contracts, she said. No one knows, or is saying, why approximately $9 million in state funding for 62 programs that provide shelter, counseling, and advocacy for victims of domestic abuse was left out of the stopgap budget. When providers finally learned they were left empty-handed, they scrambled to make up the lost money by slashing jobs and salaries and expanding client waiting lists. Although there's no indication officials intended to slice funding for domestic violence programs, the money won't be easily restored in the state's precarious economic situation. Illinois has operated without a spending plan since July 2015 because of bickering between first-term Republican Governor Bruce Bronner and Democrats who control the legislature. Bronner will deliver a budget address Wednesday to the General Assembly, as today. Dove's Incorporated domestic violence programs serve Macon, DeWitt, Moultrie, Shelby, and part of Piatt counties. In addition to a shelter that can hold up to 33 individuals, the agency provides a 24-hour hotline, legal advocacy, assistance with emergency orders of protection, life skills programming, parenting classes, and groups for both parents and children. Those efforts reached a total of 754 people in the last fiscal year, Gregory said. Really, when this comes down to it, we're talking about people's lives, Gregory said. Our services are vitally important to the people of this community. Dove has implemented a hiring freeze and is considering other options, Gregory said. The agency has also been in contact with its state representatives, as Gregory encouraged anyone who's concerned to do. Don't accept the excuse, it's the other guy, she said. At this point, it's all of us in this boat together, and the boat is sinking. It wasn't until December 16th, just 2 weeks before the temporary budget expired, that Human Services Secretary James Demas sent out a letter to all providers alerting them that the money had been left out. The program was fully funded in 2015-16 at $18.6 million, money that was tapped out by late summer. In his letter, Demas acknowledged some confusion about, quote, he acknowledged, quote, some confusion, unquote, about funding the latest spending plan and promised that it would be fully paid when available. Demas offered no explanation for the delayed announcement, and spokeswoman Megan Powers declined to answer questions about the late notice. Experienced state vendors know they sign state contracts that make payments dependent on legislative approval. But domestic violence program providers say they submitted budgets to DHS for review and in some cases had to amend them before getting DHS contract approval last spring, without notice that there wasn't money forthcoming. Quote, they've already spent that money and they're struggling, unquote, said Vicki Smith, executive director of the Illinois Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Of the 62 domestic violence sites that receive state funding, 39 also receive federal money because they provide 24-hour shelters, Smith said. That amounts to about 2 months' worth of operations. Some agencies are zealously fundraising, although Gretchen Vapnar, executive director of Community Crisis Center in Elgin, lamented, most of our donors have already paid their taxes. At the Center for Domestic Peace in Chicago, which provide counseling to offenders programs, manager Mike Fennerman said the agency's highest paid employees agreed to take a 5-10% cut in salary after receiving the DHS news. Representative Greg Harris, Chicago, Democratic budget negotiator, saw his House-approved January plan to provide emergency funding of $6.6 million die in the Senate. The state lacks, quote, a consistent message, quote, to vendors and their financial support, he said. They had contracts to do the work, were instructed to proceed, and had the rug pulled out from under them, Harris said. Smith said she wasn't aware on June 30th when the temporary budget was approved, hours before it was to take effect, that the 800-page document had no domestic violence support. I don't care how it came down, she said. We need to fix it. End of that article. Now the last article, article of three on the front page for the Herald and Review, under the category of elections, maintaining voter rolls proved tough balancing act. Purge outdated voter rolls. Results vary in Macon County, elsewhere. This is by Ryan Voiles, H&R staff writer, and Steve Peoples, AP. Whether or not you believe that voting fraud is a problem in the United States, one thing is certain. Tidying up outdated voter rolls can be easier said than done. The issue comes across the desk every election official in the country who must keep track of the addresses of 10,000 people. The issue comes across the desk of every election official in the country who must keep track on the addresses of tens of thousands of people within their jurisdiction. In Macon County, the problem has been lessened some with the advances in computer technology. Quote, things are better than when I first started, but it's still difficult, unquote, County Clerk Steve Bean said. It's not a perfect system. As Bean said, they encountered issues whenever a student moves away for school or when a person dies outside of Illinois. In the latter case, the office has to wait for verified documents before that person can be removed from the voter rolls. Quote, unless we get verification, we cannot remove them from the roll because of hearsay, he said. The odd number of years provide a chance for election officials such as Bean to begin the clearing of the voting roll, which involves sending out a voting card to the address of every registered voter and getting updated information. During the last, quote, purge, unquote, Bean said removal notices were sent out for 3,726 people on the roll between the close of registration for the November 2014 election and the November 2016 election. But not every state has been as unfortunate. Just ask election officials in the nation's largest city. After an independent review found that New York City's voting list contained people who were dead or in prison, election officials began an aggressive purge in 2015 and in 2015 that eliminated more than 200,000 supposedly invalid registrations. The result? A record number of complaints during the 2016 presidential primary from legal voters who turned up to cast a vote but found that they were no longer registered. Democracy itself is under attack, New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, a Democrat, declared last week after announcing plans to join a federal lawsuit over the way the purge was handled. New York City's bungled purge offered a cautionary tale for elected officials, led by President Donald Trump, who warned that inaccurate voter rolls are leading to voter fraud across America. Trump has vowed to establish a commission to examine the situation. Senior policy advisor Stephen Miller sounded the alarm again Sunday. You have millions of people who are registered in two states who are dead or registered to vote, and you have 14% of non-citizens, according to academic research, at a minimum registered to vote, which is an astonishing statistic, Miller said, using a statistic hotly contested by many academics. He also claimed, without offering evidence, that voters from Massachusetts were illegally bused into New Hampshire during the last election, an allegation denied by the New Hampshire Republicans. It's unclear exactly how many people are registered to vote in America who shouldn't be. Federal law requires election officials to remove people after they die or move, but that doesn't always happen in a timely way. In New York City, the lawsuit said the Board of Elections disregarded several rules governing the maintenance of voter lists. People who hadn't voted since the 2008 presidential election were sent letters demanding they verify their status. If they didn't respond within 2 weeks, in some cases, their registration was canceled. City researchers took other unorthodox steps, too, like buying a subscription to the genealogy site Ancestry.com to help verify identities. Trump and his representatives have repeatedly cited a 2012 Pew Center study that revealed 24 million voter registrations in the U.S. were not valid or, quote, significantly inaccurate. That included 1.8 million dead people listed as eligible to vote. The study's author, David Becker, however, found no evidence of actual voter fraud. He says voter registration lists have improved since the report was released. The U.S. Election Assistance Commission reported that nearly 14.8 million names were removed from voter rolls in 2014 for reasons such as death, felony convictions, having moved or failing to respond to confirmation notices. The lists are as good as they've ever been, Becker told the AP. Still, he encouraged election officials to eliminate ineligible registrations. Nothing else, he said. Improved voter rolls help to improve confidence in the electoral system. New York City is hardly alone in its push to root out ineligible voters. Republican election officials in Florida and Colorado launched aggressive efforts to eliminate non-citizens and otherwise ineligible voters from their rolls before the 2012 election. But after warning that tens of thousands of non-citizens may have been registered, 141 cases were confirmed in Colorado and 207 in Florida. It is to every, quote, it's to everyone's benefit to have our rolls clean, but it's also to our benefit to make sure we're doing it in a way that doesn't disenfranchise eligible voters, unquote, said Myrna Perez, deputy director of the Brennan Center's Democracy Program, who authored an extensive study of voter purges in 2008. Leaving them in a messy state can also undermine confidence. New York Republican Party Chairman Ed Cox is among those who's sure it could lead to fraud. I think, quote, I think they're perfectly happy to let some of those names just be there so they can use them with respect to people voting who shouldn't vote, he told the AP. In an important election, they bring in buses of people from New Jersey and they'll take them from poll to places. We don't have poll watchers and a good ballot security in place, unquote. There is no evidence of Cox's claim. On the second page of the first section, snow endangers bison. Bison cars endangered by deep snow in Wyoming's Grand Teton. Cheyenne, Wyoming. Unusually deep snow in Grand Teton National Park has made life dangerous for bison lumbering on the park's only plowed highway and for motorists traveling the route, prompting park officials to escort the big animals to safer areas and urge drivers to slow down, park officials said Tuesday. The problem is that bisons, which can weigh up to 2,000 pounds, prefer to use the road rather than struggle through the 3 feet of snow that accumulated recently. Vehicles have killed at least one and possibly two bison in the park so far this year. On Saturday, a truck killed a bison on US 2689-191. A bison struck in January has yet to be found. Cars and trucks killed five bison and injured a sixth in the park in all of 2016. Hoping to prevent a run of collisions that can be just as dangerous for motorists, park officials and trucks guided small groups of bison along several miles of the highway Saturday and again Monday. They're definitely very tired, so we make a long, slow escort to get them to safer areas, said park spokeswoman Denise German. Park officials also plowed a side road they usually don't bother clearing to help bison move to areas with less snow covering the shrubs and grass they like to eat. Moose have also been spotted taking advantage of the plowed route through Grand Teton, German said. Deep snow has put wild animals in close quarters with people elsewhere in the Rocky Mountain region this winter. Oregon wildlife officials recently killed five cougars that left the snowy wilderness to feed on pets and chickens in a town. Wintry weather in the Rockies has also been unusually hazardous for antelope, which have been stranded on river ice, and horses unlucky enough to get stuck out in deepening snow. On the National Elk Refuge, just south of Grand Teton, supplemental feeding of elk and bison with alfalfa pellets began 3 weeks earlier than usual because the snow covered up their natural food. Then even more snow fell. So far this month, Jackson Hole at the base of the Teton Range in the park has been walloped with more than 30 inches of storms. The snow and wind cut off electricity to parts of the popular resort area and closed Jackson Hole Mountain Resort for 5 days. Normally jubilant about extreme weather, ski resort officials reopened Monday after a big hit at the peak season. End of the article. And the last article on page 2 is gene editing to avoid disease is possible. Don't expect designer babies, but ethics report looking to the future. No designer babies, but gene editing to avoid disease, maybe. This is AP Washington. Don't expect designer babies anytime soon, but a major new ethics report leaves open the possibility of one day altering human heredity to fight genetic diseases with stringent oversight using new tools that precisely edit genes inside living cells. What's called genome editing already is transforming biological research and is being used to develop treatments for patients struggling with a range of diseases. The science is nowhere near ready for a huge next step that raises ethical questions. Altering sperm, eggs, or embryos so that babies don't inherit a disease that runs in the family, says a report Tuesday from the National Academy of Sciences and National Academy of Medicine. But if scientists learn how to safely pass alterations of the genetic code to future generations, the panel said germline editing could be attempted under strict criteria. Okay, germline is their name for it. Quote, germline, unquote. Including that it targets a serious disease with no reasonable alternative and is conducted under rigorous oversight. Caution is absolutely needed, But it being cautious does not mean prohibition, said bioethicist R. Alta Sharo of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This committee is not saying we will or should do germline heritable, H-E-R-I-T-A-B-L-E. I would call it inheritable editing. What we are saying is that we can identify a set of strict conditions under which it would be permissible to do it, Charles added, but we are far, far away from being ready to try, unquote. Genome editing should not go beyond healing the sick and enhance traits such as physical strength, what's commonly called desire babies, the panel stressed. But the public should get involved in these debates now to say what might one day be acceptable. A long-awaited report offers advice. The prestigious academies cannot set policy, but it is considered a step toward creating international norms for responsible development of this powerful technology. The U.S. National Academies and its counterparts in Britain and China have been holding international meetings with the hope of doing just that. Quote, genome editing is a new tool for gene therapy and it has tremendous promise, unquote, Charo said. But, she added, it has to be pursued in a way that promotes well-being and is responsible, respectful, and fair. Genome editing is essentially a biological version of cut-and-paste software, allowing scientists to turn genes on or off, repair or modify them inside living cells. There are a few older methods, but one with the wonky name CRISPR, Cas9, is much faster, cheaper, and similar to use that it has spurred an explosion of research. CRISPR-Cas9 is spelled this way. It's all caps, C-R-I-S-P-R, CRISPR, dash, C-A-S-9. Under development are ways to treat a range of diseases from sickle cell and hemophilia to cancer. In lab experiments using human cells or animals engineered with human like disorders, scientists are unraveling how gene defects fuel disease and are even trying to grow transplantable human organs inside pigs. That kind of research is very promising, is adequately regulated today, and should continue at full speed, the National Academies panel concluded. When it comes to the more sci-fi sounding uses, it's quite possible scientists will learn how to perform germline editing in 5 to 10 years, said panel co-chair Richard Hines of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Safety is one reason for caution, he said, as scientists will have to learn whether editing one gene has unwanted downstream effects. Some critics argue that families plagued by inherited diseases already have other alternatives. Adopt, use donated eggs, or undergo in vitro fertilization and discard resulting embryos that inherit the bad gene. But Charo noted sometimes parents carry two copies of a lethal gene, guaranteeing any child inherit it. Others oppose the discarding of embryos for religious reasons. For some families, quote, you can see there would be strong arguments for doing it, unquote, if the other criteria are met, said Robin Lowell Badge of Britain's Francis Crick Institute. Some countries prohibit any germline editing research. Others, such as Britain, allow laboratory research with genome editing in embryos, not for pregnancy, but to understand human development. In the U.S., scientists can perform laboratory embryo research only with private, not government, funding. Any attempted pregnancy would require permission from Food and Drug Administration, which is currently prohibited from using federal funds to review any such request. Quote, the bottom line is there's no planetary government with enforcement power, unquote, Charo noted Tuesday. End of that article. End of page 2. Next, on page 3, the end. 21 Film Project concludes its run. Land of Lincoln teamed with Celebration to host events for 9 years. This is local. 21 Film Project concludes. This is by Tim Kane, the Herald and Review Entertainment editor. After a 9-year run, the Land of Lincoln Credit Union has ended its 21 Film Project. Launched in 2007, the film festival drew entries from around the country. It became part of the Decatur Celebration in 2011, with entrant screenings taking place at the Avon Theater, then the Decatur Civic Center Theater. Films were also screened through the Decatur Celebration in an air-conditioned tent set up in the event's Black Lot area. In a news release, the credit union said, "Well, each year became better than the last, and while we were able to witness firsthand the talents of thousands of creative individuals, we have decided not to continue with the 21 Film Project Festival for 2017 and beyond," unquote. Quote, "They were a great partner for us," unquote, said Decatur Celebration producer Laurie Sturgill. Quote, "We loved having them in the black back lot, but sometimes events just run their course." Sturgill plans to meet with the Land of Lincoln representatives to discuss future possibilities. In a Facebook post, the credit union said, "After 9 years, we felt the festival ran its course, and we're excited to try something new in the future. We plan to continue supporting the arts in new and innovative ways." That still leaves filmmakers, cast, and crews with one fewer place to display their creative work. Decatur's Hugh Sullivan entered the four-minute film contest each year, making the final cut all but the first year. He submitted the winning film in 2012 with Chupacabra Country, and it was a two-time winner for both Best Direction and Best Screenplay. "It leaves a void for a good core filmmaker," Sullivan said. "It was something I aimed for every year." One of the advantages was success with that made people more likely to jump on board when I was doing projects. "Hopefully we're not just out of luck. I heard from a guy who said, 'What do we do now?' And I put him in touch with the Champagne Film Club. They're having a 48-hour film contest this weekend." While the contest thrived thanks to, in part, to widespread communication on social media, widespread entries may have been costly. They were pulling in films from people in film school in California, Sullivan said. "I was also told there had been times recently when there was limited entries and people were not following the rules," unquote, and end of that article. Quickly, the caption of a picture with an Elvis impersonator and folks who were the king and queen said, "For Valentine's Day, Scott Parks performed as Elvis and sings his classic hits during the annual Sweetheart Dance Tuesday at the Decatur Rehab and Healthcare Center. The dances for the clients at the center and Carl Martin and Jane were crowned as 2017 King and Queen." Next, we'll do some briefs as we end this section. Heart Seminar, cardiologist Louis Casares from Prairie Heart Institute will host a Lunch and Learn seminar from noon to 1 on Friday, February 17th at HSHS St. Mary's Hospital, Assisi Room. Space is limited. Reservations required. Call 464-2510, 464-2510, or email Laura Brown. Email laura.brown1 at hshs.org to reserve a spot. Chicago. Exelon lawsuit. Competitors to Chicago-based Exelon have filed a lawsuit in Chicago opposing legislation that provides billions of dollars in subsidy to the power giant. The legislation approved in December provides $235 million per year to Exelon to keep unprofitable nuclear plants running in Clinton and the Quad Cities. More than 4 million customers of power distributing subsidiaries ComEd and Ameren will pay more to finance the plan. That is the end of part one for February 15th, 2017, Herald and Review, as read by Debbie. I will be back with you soon.